Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ken Hudson Show. Ken has investigated the strange and the unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us through tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good evening. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show right here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio. Coming to you live from our studios in El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Now, tonight, we've got an unusual show for you. Second hour, I have four officers from the Commander General Staff College that are going to be talking to you about the fun and excitement of being deployed, something that's pretty regularly scheduled for almost everybody who wants to make the military career. And they're going to be available for you to ask them questions about any topic you want to talk about. I don't fly air cover for my guests. If you ask a question, it's up to them to give you an answer. First hour, I've got a very unusual guest. It's Dr. Barbara Stone, author of Invisible Roots, How Healing Past Life Trauma Can Liberate Your Present. She is a PhD, a workshop presenter, bilingual psychotherapist, and a professor at Energy Medicine University. So we're going to be talking to her about her new book and about past life traumas and various other things that come up. So without further ado, problem.
Yes, and it felt real because of the temperature change in the room. I understand that when someone dies and their soul can't cross into the next world, their spirit stays earthbound and it draws energy from the surrounding area, so that's why it's so cold when there's an earthbound spirit around. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know what to do, so I prayed real hard. I said, God, you got to tell me what to do. Help. And what came to me, what Spirit guided me to do, was I just said, well, if Dad came to therapy, let's talk with Dad. So we did a process called voice dialogue with Hal Stone invented it. We just put an extra chair out, and we invited Dad to stay in that chair, and then we dialogued through her consciousness with what she wanted to say to her father and what her father wanted to say to her. She wound up doing some really important, it was an extremely difficult case because she had been so badly abused, and I started to learn energy therapy because of that case, because just talking only made it worse. I had to find something that would actually melt the traumatic imprints. So I learned eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, and thought field therapy and emotional freedom technique, and a whole host of other therapies that work with authority, which at the time was the Catholic Church. That was the strongest political power. So a lot of us healers who do some of these new therapies have a little bit of an uneasiness about it because we remember being burned at the stake and we don't want that to happen again. So we need to go back and clear those traumatic patterns so that we're free to really let our light shine. What even if our whole family gets killed, we can always reincarnate and find each other again. Death is not the end of our consciousness.
So basically what you're saying is, for all practical purposes, time can be rewritten.
Exactly. Exactly. There's a little Charlie Brown cartoon that says, "I don't worry too much about tomorrow, but I do keep hoping that yesterday will get better." I use a different method. I'm one of the few that uses this method. It's called muscle testing, where you make a statement and then you test the strength of a muscle, because our muscle tension is stronger when we say the truth, and it's not as strong when we don't. So I get all of my information from muscle testing, and the client stays in a totally conscious state of mind.
Okay. What? Give me an example of muscle testing.
Well, if you'd like to try it yourself, or if our listeners in the chat room would like to try it, you can raise your right knee a few inches off the floor, take your right hand and push on that right knee, and see if the knee can stay up even when your hand is pushing. So this is just a test of the strength of your thigh muscle. 1 second, and then push on that same muscle and see what happens.
My name is Tom Smith. Still there.
Okay. Was there any difference in the strength of that muscle when you said something that was not true?
If so, I couldn't tell what it was.
Okay. Some people can't right away. That's a test that works for some people and not for others. I would guess that about half of our listening audience that might work, and another half might need to do something else. It's a skill. Muscle testing is also called applied kinesiology in the chiropractic field and clinical kinesiology in the psychotherapy field. It's a skill that we develop to really feel the subtle differences in the muscle response when we say something that's true and something that's not true. And do you realize, Ken, that if you can get access to someone's system, it's like the binary system of the computer. It's all built on zeros and ones. If you can test true and not true, then you can access a deeper level of wisdom about what's happening in a person's life. For instance, one of the ways I use that, if there's a physical problem that has not been responsive to medical care and someone wants to complement their medical treatment, and I do recommend they keep on getting their medical treatment. Doctors have saved my life 3 times, and I love the medical profession. But if they want to add something to their medical treatment, then I can muscle test the origin of this problem is something physical. And if that doesn't test as true, I can say it's something about the energy flow or an emotional issue or a mental issue or what I call in my book the intuitive level issues. They're in between our mental body and our spiritual body. It's what people call the woo-woo area of past lives, earthbound spirit attachment, curses and hexes, energetic cords, vows, ancestral wounds, sometimes even dark spirits that have invaded the energy field, that have intruded into someone's energy field and cause aberrant behaviors.
A listener from Peru, Benema Chaska, said, being trained as a lawyer, that muscular reaction would not apply.
Being trained, I didn't catch that word.
Being trained as a lawyer.
Oh.
Means that wouldn't apply.
Well, it's not something I would want to use in court. However, there is a thing called...
having an affair with a warrant officer by the name of... Jackson, who happened to be, and a warrant officer Jackson, different one, was the man giving the lie detector test. He was having an affair not only with the wife but with the daughter, and he was afraid that Jackson had found out, and he's sitting behind him with a pistol. So he was literally freaking out.
You know, that's a science. It's actually about 85% accurate. And there are subtleties that if a person tries to make an answer come out the way they want it, like maybe someone would test, chocolate is good for me, and they really want chocolate to be good for them, they could influence it. Or if they've got some other program running, an overriding strong emotional response, I would think that man would be fearing for his life right then.
Oh, he was. But
those are the four organs that trauma disrupts, and that's usually the sequence that they need to be rebalanced in. So I've heard that sometimes people have gone for hypnotherapy, and usually it works, but once in a while they get back into the trauma and it just brings up everything again and there's no resolution. When you add the tapping, like for the hypnotherapist client needs, and it always works. I would say it's 99% effective.
Well, you know, I've seen a lot of various techniques over the years, and certainly it is raises a lot of questions in my mind. Does it actually?
And then when we see a similar issue in our life again, it triggers that same trauma response, like a veteran of the war maybe being around a car that backfired and made a loud noise. That could trigger memories of cannons and rockets and bombs going off in the war. So it seems one of the theories is that the tapping disrupts that automatic trauma response part. Only the part that was in conscious awareness at the time of death goes into the light. And the other part that was split off stays sort of encapsulated in its trauma. So sometimes I have a person that died in a traumatic situation and they say, well, I see myself going into the light, and then I want to check, did all of that person's personality go into the light, or was there a split-off part? Spirits is one of the dangers of being a soldier, and that's that sometimes when a soldier returns from war, there might be the earthbound spirit of an enemy, or even more than one of the enemies that that soldier killed. If the enemy was angry and vengeful, it might like latch on to the soldier to try to punish it for killing it. Alternatively, sometimes the comrades of the soldier, the fellow soldiers that were killed in the war, might attach and come home. Now, how someone would know that would be if they had feelings and thoughts that didn't feel like their own, and if they were very tired. That's the biggest sign of having someone else's energy field linked into yours.
So what do you do about something like that?
Well, what I do is if a soldier comes to me, I do some muscle testing and see, are there any separate energy fields that are linked in draining? It's kind of like someone draining your battery. And if so, then I do the tapping for those spirits. And I have done that work, and it makes a profound shift for the soldier of getting themselves back. It's like their wife will say, oh, you know, they're just not the same. They're on edge, and they're irritable. And once you clear those spirit attachments, the real person is back.
So you're basically talking about possession.
Well, possession is one of the levels of attachment. As I understand the phenomenon, first it links into the outer edges of your energy field, but over time it works its way in closer and closer, deeper and deeper, until in a case of possession it could seem to at times take over the consciousness of the person.
Hmm.
Although cases of full possession are rare, there is sometimes a momentary possession, like in a fit of rage someone might hit somebody or hurt someone or even take a life, and it could be influenced by somebody else's anger. It's very sad when that happens, because of course the one who committed the murder is the responsible party.
Well, I only know of one case where demonic possession has been used as a defense and didn't fly too well.
Yes. Well, you know, sometimes it's not a demon possessing, but just a person. There's a case the whole system was really clear. It sounds pretty wild, doesn't it?
Yeah, because of the three people involved, all three are now dead.
Yes.
So how did you communicate with them?
Through the woman's best friend, who could sense spirits. She could feel spiritual presence, and she could feel what was happening. She knew all three people. So she, in a sense, was acting like a medium. And I find that most people who have a spirit attachment, they can be a medium for that spirit, because that spirit is linked into their mental field. It's kind of like being stuffed into a telephone booth with somebody and being able to read their mind.
Well, that happens all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now, has there ever been...
And he had a protocol in hypnosis. When he ran into a dark energy, he just treated it like a job and did a job interview. He had this amazing protocol that I started using, where you ask the dark spirit, what's your job? And it'll say, well, I'm trying to, you know, destroy this person or make him kill himself or something like that. And then you ask, who are you working for, the darkness or the light? And, of course, they're working for the darkness. And then you ask, what did your employer tell you about the light? And then you get all of the cognitive distortions, all of the lies that the dark energies believe. Like, they think the light is dangerous, it would burn them up, it would kill them, it would annihilate them, that there's a war going on and it's either them or the light, and they're fighting the light because they're, you know, just trying to survive. It's like self-defense. And then this is the genius that Baldwin did. He got those dark energies to convert into light workers. It makes a huge difference in their life. Now, does that sound wild or what?
Yes, it does, because that sounds like the dark energy actually is alive as we understand being alive.
Well, it seems to have consciousness. They don't have physical bodies, but they have energetic forces and consciousness, and they seem to plan women are bad, and he's
evil.
Got that program running. All women are bad. Well, that acts like a dark influence on his relationship behavior. If you can address that, go to its origin and transform it, heal the trauma, then that man will be free to make healthy relationships. Likewise, if you have a dark energy of any kind running, if you get to understand it and transform it, then you have completeness and wholeness rather than being split off.
Hmm.
It's kind of a new idea.
I'll give it that.
But I'll have to say that clinically it works extremely well, and that's why I'm writing about it.
Well, I've known many psychiatrists over the years in various social situations. And without exception, I found most of them to use the legal term to be crazier than a road lizard. Which does raise interesting views about some of the more far-out theories.
Yes. Well, it's sort of known in the realms of psychotherapy and psychiatry that the only people who are really interested in do it inside sacred space, I set up a pyramid of light around me and my client, and I post archangels at all four corners and at the apex, and I set the intention to work for the highest good of everyone and everything, including the dark energy. Now, sometimes I work with a dark angel, and they get very hostile. They say nasty things to me, like I ask, who are you working for, the darkness or the light? And they say, boy, lady, you're pretty stupid if you can't figure out that one when my mission is to destroy this person's life. But I do something. It's a technique I learned from a man who teaches a course, Bullies to Buddies. If you have someone who's a bully, like an enemy, if you just keep treating them like a friend, eventually they come around. So I try to make that dark energy by addressing its needs and its distortions and letting it find... Oh, okay.
You do that once, they avoid confrontation after that.
Okay.
And that's
right.
Really the issue is avoiding the confrontation.
Mm.
Now, of course, there are certain things you have to keep in mind in doing that. You have to be equal to or bigger than the bully.
Exactly. You have to know you have the ability to punch their lights out and not let them punch yours out.
Yeah, that it would be counterproductive to be punched out.
Right, right. That wouldn't accomplish much.
But it, you know, in a perfectly straightforward fashion, when the bullying doesn't work, normally they go find another victim, and that's really all you want.
Right. You know, Kenny, that we are all connected in the web of life. And I want to help my brother who's caught in the darkness so that everybody can go to heaven.
Well, I had a pastor with an interesting outlook. I was raised Southern Baptist, which is a very strange way to be raised. And my grandmother was... had decided I was going to hell. So she would invite the pastor over for Sunday dinner, which was part of what one of the bennies of being pastor in the South. You always got invited to somebody's house.
Oh, great, yes.
And after several Sundays of this, he finally went to her and said, look, I've talked to him, and I really enjoy eating here, but ain't nothing in the world I can do for him. Why would I have faith in somebody telling me what is supposed to be the truth when they can't answer my questions?
Right.
To me, I was being very logical.
Yes. And you were wanting answers. It's like your lawyer training of let's get to the truth of what's going on here. Let's find out what is this all about.
You were talking about past lives. Interestingly enough, my great-great-great...
...of the traits through DNA, but that wouldn't be such a strong case because then everybody in the family should have those traits. Another would be that perhaps your great-great-grandfather, this Confederate officer, the doctor, was one of your own previous lives, and so the soul essence that he had is the same soul essence that you have, with the same preference in life.
So
interesting. But I have to ask you one more question, Ken.
What's that?
Do you think that you're going to hell, or do you just think they thought you were?
Well, I think because I didn't fit in the mold, within the parameters of this church, I fell in the category of you're not being obedient, therefore you have to be punished. You're going to go to hell.
Right.
No?
Right. That's kind of an inclusion-exclusion. Anyone included in our group who believes our way is going to heaven, and anyone in the other group is going to hell.
And they used to upset them when I started arguing religion with them.
Yeah.
Because I read everything I get my hands on since I was old enough to walk, so I knew, in some cases, I knew more about it than they did.
Can liberate your present. And my website is www.souldetective.net, S-O-U-L, detective.net. There's a link on my website where you can go right to Amazon for the book. And there's a list of my trainings if anybody is interested in learning how to do this work.
Okay, well, I appreciate you being with me. And we will certainly, Dark. Maybe it will come back. And I can finish with getting everyone set up. Ah, we are back. Let's see, we have Major Greg is Army SP Corps, physical therapist.
Yes, sir. And
we have Major Sutton is Signal Corps.
Yes.
And Major Dixon is Armor.
That's right.
And Major Kilburn is Field Artillery.
Yes, I am.
Well, very good. Now, one thing I don't do is fly air cover for the guest. If someone calls in and asks a question, then either tell them you don't know or answer it. There are no right or wrong answers on this show. Your opinion is your opinion. And the while we have a little over 2 million who, give or take, who listen each night, just say what you think as I start asking you questions. Now, the you all are, looks like most of you are, what is it, ILE? ILE? ILE.
Yes, sir. It's intermediate level education. Formerly used to be the what they call the Commanded General Staff College, or CGSC, would be now.
Okay. Have all of you been deployed? It looks like deployed to Bosnia with Major Greg.
That's right.
Well, now, I've had only a few that have been to Bosnia. You were with the 41st Combat Support Hospital. What was it like in Bosnia during the time you were there?
It was pretty quiet. It was essentially just a peacekeeping mission. Being there at the Combat Support Hospital, we were essentially there as a contingency, you know, just in case there were people who were injured in the peacekeeping operation. We were there with, surgical expertise and everything else under the anything else you could think of in terms of taking care of soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
But I was personally, as a physical therapist, I was very busy because when any time people in the Army get bored, they tend to work out a lot and play a lot of sports.
Also, the force generation planning for the signal units coming into and rotating out of theater. And, you know, was an action officer for a few other things.
What, all in all, during the time you were there, what was the general demeanor of the population that you came in contact with? Or the way we have carried out the mission in Iraq has been successful or not?
I would say yes, sir. You know, I was there during the surge period where we had a lot of additional troops coming in. And from the start of the war to where we are now, I believe we have gained a lot of support in the Iraqi population.
When we leave...
You know, the government aid them as we need, along with the State Department, other agencies. So I believe the government will continue to function after our troops have pulled out.
Okay. Major Dixon.
Yes, sir.
Your armor.
I am.
ROTC. You were an armor company commander for 3,200 square meters along the Syrian border.
Yeah, 3,200 square kilometers, yeah.
What was your experience with the Iraqi and Syrian people in that area?
I didn't really interact with the Syrian people. You know, we had one kind of humorous incident in which one of my platoons had some tea with some of the Syrian army guys on the other side, but most of our work was with the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, and the Iraqi border police. We were at the beginning of a lot of the transition of giving more battle space over to the Iraqi army. So we worked a lot with trying to get them to start to conduct their own missions and assume responsibility for the space that I had. The interaction with the Iraqi police and the Iraqi border police and the municipal leaders and such, it was just a mountain of stuff for me to handle, and it, you know, basically I just sort of dabbled in a bunch of things because I had such a large area to cover with such a small force. But I'd say that it was primarily because you know, it was a relatively permissive zone. They weren't being asked to do a whole lot of heavy fighting, and I had a significant connection to a bunch of Kurdish officers that I felt were more than up to the task.
What, now when we went in, we basically disbanded the Iraqi army and rebuilt it from scratch. Am I correct? Just out of curiosity, do you think we could have accomplished the mission faster had we used the existing army and just changed the leadership?
Yeah, I really don't know. I think that our biggest uphill battle was from the beginning just trying to understand the different culture. Their way of doing things is not our way of doing things. And, you know, maybe you could have said that you had a unit that was readily available, already qualified on their weapons, knew how to patrol, and you'd have that working for you. But would you have spent twice as much time trying to discern who was really your ally and who wasn't? Or trying to find out where the, you know, stay behind Saddam loyalists were and who they weren't. I don't think you can really make that assessment. It's kind of, you know, you can only really look at what you did, not what you didn't do.
Well, good point. Monday morning quarterback has always been pretty much a waste of time and effort.
Right.
Major Kilburn, you
yes,
spent
sir.
You spent time in Baghdad with a
yes.
transition team.
Yes, that was my second tour to Iraq. That tour was September 2008 to September 2009. Before 2004, I was a battery commander in a different part of Baghdad.
What were your experience with the Iraqi people?
Well, actually, I'd have to say it was generally positive. I think that really in 2004, we still had a lot of support. People were still fresh to the idea of a new start, a new government, that sense of normalcy and returning to a good life.
How do you think they're going to take in the long run to the idea of a democratic government, one man, one vote, when they've for thousands of years been tribal with a strong man making decisions?
Actually, I think that they'll take quite well to it. I think they already have. This was after the transfer of authority to Iraq for security, so it was good to see the Iraqi security forces that I was working with. They really took charge, and people were not intimidated. They got out and they cast their vote. So I really think that Iraq was ripe for democracy, and I think that they're really taking to the idea of one man, one vote.
But do you think they'll stand up and defend it if push comes to shove?
You know, the Iraqis have a lot of pride. They are very proud of their culture and their history. They trace their tribal history. They can trace it back to the days of Babylon. And I think that if anyone in the region comes in and tries to push that newfound freedom, I think the Iraqis will push back.
Well, that's good to hear. See, people have changed.
I don't know if I would call it a change. Again, you know, they have such a rich history and such a strong sense of family, identity, tribe. I think that the way the new government has been structured, I think it actually takes advantage of that while trying to cultivate a sense of nationalism, a belief in the greater Iraq, how we have a belief in the greater United States of America, but we all celebrate our individual identities as well.
Okay. Major Coburn, any idea what your next assignment will be?
Well, most likely I'll be going to a brigade combat team somewhere. Those are where they need the staff officers.
Think you'll be deployed again?
I think that my family and I are probably counting on me being deployed at least one more time in the current conflicts. I've never been to Afghanistan, but looking at the pace of operations there, I think that we could probably, if we want to do things right, count on a couple more years of operations there before we can begin to ramp things down.
How do you think the change to General Petraeus?
General Petraeus will not rock the boat, as I've heard some people say. I think that he's got a clear direction. He understands what the president's policy is, and I think he's going to execute and get the job done.
And not give interviews to Rolling Stone magazine.
Well, that was unfortunate. That whole issue that happened with
any desire to spend any time in Afghanistan?
I mean, if I was assigned to a unit that was going there, sure, I'd love to see the other theater. It's better to have a well-rounded perspective than to always be going back to the same fight. But, you know, it's not really one of those things that we get to pick from the card deck.
Yeah, you're right about that. How do you think General Petraeus' new assignment?
I have every confidence that missions will continue on a path to success.
Okay. Let's see. I don't want to leave anybody out here. Major Sutton.
Sir.
Any idea what you're going to be doing next?
Well, my branch manager just sent out a list of assignments that will be coming open as soon as the cycle, as far as when they'll be headed over to Afghanistan, probably.
Okay. Any view from you about how General Petraeus' assignment's going to affect ground operations?
I think my colleagues have pretty well hit it. I know General Petraeus is still in his first month over there, so I think he is going to take some time. He's going to get a better understanding of the situation, what's going on. You know, as stated before, he was the CENTCOM commander, so he had the he was in charge of both wars currently. So he did have that background going in, but I think he's going to take some time. He's going to see what the situation is, and then he'll start making changes based off of that.
Okay. I had a chance to know him slightly. Seemed to be an individual who had his act together. Okay. Major Gregg, any idea what you'll be doing next?
At this point, I'm supposed to go to Fort Drum in upstate New York and be the chief of the physical therapy clinic there.
Truly an exciting place.
I hear it's exciting in the winter. In fact, they issue you a snowblower if you live on post. Looking forward to that.
I've heard that. I was threatened with assignment there, but I managed to avoid it.
I imagine at some point in the next year or two, I'll wind up deploying with a combat support hospital over to Iraq or Afghanistan, seeing as I'm on the short list within my corps of folks who have not deployed recently.
Well, since it was kind of an informal aide to post commander. Whenever he wanted to stir things up, he would threaten me with assignment to Korea, which was where they sent the bad boys in those days. And well, I don't know. We wound up in quite a brouhaha over that. I was an instructor at the infantry school, and they decided to have me concurrently continue to instruct at the same time I was taking an advanced course at the infantry school.
I was just going to say, he certainly won't be able to take the identical approach of Iraq and apply it to Afghanistan, but I have confidence that he's a smart individual, and he'll be able to develop that awareness of the situation in Afghanistan that is necessary to do a good job there.
I'm supposed to have him on for an interview. I don't know what the logistics of that are going to be. It should definitely be interesting. Just out of curiosity, we're dealing with a very, very old civilization, if you will, in the loosest sense of the term. As far back as you can trace it, the Afghanistan people have always answered to a strong leader. And when they haven't had a strong leader, that's when everything has gone to hell in a handbasket.
I really think that if we took a look at how the tribal sects work and how the larger scheme of the larger tribes connect together, and we try to make that work into some sort of democratic system and show them that it could work that way, that they could sort of figure it out on their own, and make it, fit the mold of what they currently have better than us just trying to say that every single person, we draw some arbitrary lines on the ground, which is what's caused all the problems in the past with colonialism, and let them just sort of figure out how their tribes can fit into the mold of a of an electoral or a representative type government.
Well, certainly that would be a much more civilized way to handle it, I would think.
I mean, if you listen to all the interviews and the reviews up to this point, you're just never going to get past the fact
and take on the flavor of the area where they are.
Well, but you all look for a successful conclusion, I suspect. That's just out for anybody to respond to.
Yes, I think we are looking for a successful conclusion. Does success mean that they have a complete...
That's true. The in looking at, you know, I've had numerous officers on the show from every branch and within each military branch, you know, all the subcultures, I guess you could say. And what's been interesting is I've only had one that refused to deviate from what you might call the school solution and the discussions. The majority have approached it in their own fashion. And come up with pretty much what you all have said tonight, which I find very interesting that everyone seems to agree that they'll get a democratic government.
You know, rooting out Al-Qaeda, keeping the Taliban under control, essentially keeping that area stable enough with whatever form of democracy or other government is in place so that we don't again see, you know, terrorist training camps in those areas that are, you know, sending terrorists to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I would read it.
Okay. Do you think the Afghani people are really supporting the...
I think that, yes, it is easy for the Taliban to hide amongst the population. That's one of the fundamental tenets of an insurgency going back to Mao in China. The Taliban they employ a wide range of tactics to ensure that support, from monetary payoffs to threatening families. So until we have that stable security apparatus where if you get threatened, you can go to an impartial policeman and get that government protection, that is going to be a concern. So I think the reintegration, as it moves on from President Karzai's plan, also building up the security apparatus, the police and the army in Afghanistan as an impartial force, I think that is going to start setting the conditions to where the Taliban cannot hide anymore. And impartial in the sense of a tribal-based police force that is subservient to a national police force or whatever they can come up with that really fits their culture and the conditions in that part of the world. Really, at this point in the counterinsurgency, I think that our biggest two parts is to give them that security assistance, to give them the breathing room to grow and get them
quite ready to take care of itself. We have an obligation to finish what we started. So to say that, you know, the threat is difficult because they're hiding amongst the population and we should just pull out, it's just ridiculous to me. The second thing I would say about that is, as far as terror groups and insurgents being able to hide amongst the population, that's always going to be there, regardless. I mean, any government. You know, I don't even remember the total number of terror groups that are on the CIA watch list right now, but I do remember that something like five of them live in Northern Ireland. We have terror groups in our own country. The question is whether or not the Afghan people, the Afghan government, can suppress it enough so that it's not a threat to them and not a threat to us.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, us along with the rest of NATO see that it's, you know, potentially a threat to us unless we can establish a security force in the government that's capable of suppressing that extremist-type behavior on their own. Now, as far as the second question about our forces and what they can and can't engage, and then coming home and going crazy, I don't know that the rules of engagement are directly connected to whether or not someone comes home in a right frame of mind. The bottom line is that our soldiers are tired. We've been fighting a war for a long time in two fronts, and that takes a toll on a lot of people. Unless they have good coping mechanisms in place, you're going to have a handful of people that come back altered, and that's part of our casualties of war. It's stuff that we don't see when we have a high attritional war, when everybody just comes back in a box. You see more of it when people have seen atrocious things and survived. So that's something that is a cost, a price that we have to bear whenever we commit our forces somewhere. I guess that's basically where I would go with answering that writer.
If I could chime in from a medical viewpoint.
By all means.
You know, saying people are coming home going crazy, that's a little strong way to put it, but I think in terms of the post-traumatic stress disorder, we may be seeing more of it now than we've seen in past engagements, because now the medical system is much more robust and is working harder to identify these problems and also treat these problems. So they're bringing it to the forefront instead of ignoring it and kind of pushing it to the side.
Well, certainly in past engagements, a lot of, especially the VA for various and sundry reasons, and the philosophy is there's been a recognizable change, which is a good thing. Okay, even though you all have been so shy during the interview for the most part, anyone have any comments they want to make? Don't everybody speak at one time.
Okay, this is Major Kilburn. I'd like to say that I've been in the Army. I was enlisted in the reserves for a little while, early 90s, then got my commission in 98 and went on active duty. And ever since, we've committed troops in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places too, South America, Horn of Africa. I've really seen an upsurge in just the appreciation for our servicemen and women. And I want to take this opportunity to tell the United States, thank you very much for your support. It is an honor to serve, and just all the well wishes from millions of people all over the country.
And Major Sutton, Army Signal Corps. Major Gregg, what we used to call the medical corps, physical therapist, also Army.
Right.
Second?
I say medical specialist corps.
Everybody's a specialist these days. And, of course, we have Major Kilburn, field artillery. Well, I might make note, went to Arizona State University and spent an exciting 3 years at Fort Drum, New York.
And lived to tell about it.
And survived.
I still have 10 fingers and 10 toes and one nose.
Hey, when you spend that long up there, anything's possible. If it wasn't covered, it usually fell off eventually. Well, I appreciate you all being with me. California Living, while he asked some pointed questions, said the men and women who serve are supported by the American people. I, for one, hold them dear to my heart, which is, having been there and done that in many places, I certainly identify with what what you all deal with. And certainly, you know, I enjoy having officers on the show. General Caldwell, asking questions at times. Quite a lot of it's just to see if I can still intimidate officers as I used to. For the most part, you all have given as good as I've given you, so I appreciate you being with me. And anytime you decide you want to come back, just let me know. I rarely make an accident. And when I do, I always clean it up. Now, this next hour, first, I want to tell you the first 2 hours are brought to you by Marcello's Ristorante Italiano, two locations, 1360 Lee Trevino and 5380 North Mesa. The food is absolutely top of the line. Some of the best Italian food you'll put in your mouth. They have pasta of all kinds, vegetarian plates, fish, lamb. Actually, it just described in the chat room as a variety hour, and certainly you might say that. I have authors of all types. I have I've had people talking about everything you can imagine. Last night, Yoli was not able to be with us. And we talked, I had the Hamilton Underwood, and we talked about the ghost that haunts Asarco, which is the, frankly, one of the most haunted locations in the state of Texas. You know, they're ghosts in almost every line of work you can think about. Military ghosts, good Lord. I've written two books on the ghost of Fort Bliss. And there's probably another book of stories that I could put together. Now, nobody had any doubt in a contest between a sailing ship and that carrier, who was going to win? And just as there was going to be a collision, that sailing ship vanished. Most of the sailors who saw that ship suspected it was the Flying Dutchman. And they weren't the only ones that came in contact with it. A whaling ship had an encounter in 1911. A Royal Navy ship did in 1923. And German Admiral Karl Dönitz, who actually was Hitler's successor, in 1939 had a run-in with the Flying Dutchman. Now it seems around the time of war, spirits just come out from every direction. It happened in the Spanish-American War. It happened with World War I. There were units of cavalry in the sky that took a direct hand in battles between the British Expeditionary Force and the Germans. The USS Kinnison, a destroyer in 1942, was coming into San Francisco Harbor. There was fog that morning. And they barely avoided a collision with a two-masted sailing ship. The timbers were rotted. The sails were ragged. The deck was deserted. Nobody was at the helm. And the Kinnison's radar screen was blank. But everybody saw the ship. And then it was gone. In April of 1943, the Kinnison had another run-in. On the way to her home port of San Diego, a Liberty ship appeared off her starboard bow.
And 1 minute it was there, the next minute it was gone. Radar. Now, the North American East Coast is primarily runs north and south. But there is one place where it juts out eastward a good distance. Casco Bay, Maine, during World War II became a major port. It became one of the most important seaports on the East Coast during World War II. That's where the British Navy, the Canadian Navy, and our Navy staged for the convoys that headed. Those of them, the coastal guns were on edge. You know, in the jungles of South America, I came up on several coastal gun emplacements that dated from World War I. And they were huge. And a lot of the coastal gun positions along the East Coast were simply refurbished World War I positions, heading straight towards some of the most important zones of restriction along that area of the coast. Siren scream, men ran to battle stations, ships swarmed, guns zeroed in. Now, a short way down the beach, while all this was going on, a man and a woman, not married to each other, were indulging in an amorous interlude when they heard the sirens. Suddenly they heard the guns firing and artillery shells exploded. Rock shards hit all around them. The man's first thought was that the husband of the young lady he was with had somehow taken charge of a ship and was going to blow him to smithereens for his indiscretions. But as the two in total shock stared out at the water, they realized that it wasn't for them. A Royal Navy vessel had charged out of the harbor, guns blazing. U.S. naval ships, Coast Guard cutters, were heading in their directions, firing as fast as they could. And what was interesting, it was the two on the beach who got the best look at the intruder. It wasn't a German U-boat. It wasn't even a new craft. It was a wooden sailing vessel that managed to outrun two of the most powerful navies in the world. Now, they got a chance to see the name on the back of the ship. And it said, Dash, Freeport. Now, no one could figure out what a ship was doing there that had sunk 127 years prior. Now, the Dash certainly had a reputation. Everybody who was involved with the sea in that area knew about it. Her heyday was during the War of 1812. And she was one of the greatest privateers to ever sail for this country. She never suffered defeat, never attacked an enemy ship in vain, never injured by a hostile shot, and was faster than anybody else. Now, it was built at a place called Porter's Landing in 1782. Or at least the idea took
was given birth then. The design was one of the first that Seward Porter ever put on paper. She wasn't actually launched until 1813, but she was the end-all be-all of the Seawright's art. Every design tweak possible was put into the design of that ship. This is one of the first ships that was first built as a model before the actual ship was built. And that model is actually in the Freeport Historical Society. Her design also gave birth to the later clipper ships of the next generation ship to sail. So she went out again, chased by the British again, outran them. And finally, it was decided that they'd make a whole lot of money if they turned this into a privateer. They got letters of marque from President James Madison. The U.S. Navy had its hands full with the British ships. There were only a few naval ships. Many of those were privately funded, and those with political influence wound up being the captains. People such as John Paul Jones were left on the beach because there were no ships for them. The Dash captured over 30 prizes, made a fortune for the owners and the captain. Their last voyage was January of 1815. Not knowing that Britain and the United States had tried to sign the Treaty of Ghent on Christmas Eve the previous year, the war was over, but they were going to go out and capture some more ships. Well, as the Dash put out to sea, that same night, one of the largest storms of anybody's memory came up. The wife of the captain had a premonition that she'd never see her husband again, and that proved to be true. No British records made mention of the Dash having been captured by a British ship. You know, news was notoriously slow. Well, several months after she left the area at that time of year, it was under full sail. And yet, he was sitting there on the water, knew there was no wind. It was a dead calm. The mystery ship came to a stop about 30 feet from him. And in the moonlight, he could see the nameplate on the stern of the vessel. Dash. Freeport. Well, a day or so later, another fisherman saw the Dash. And then another, and another. And then finally, 17 crewmen on board a schooner by the name of Betty McComber were coming in with a big catch when the Dash passed them like they were sitting still.
And whether it's calm, a storm, the tide's coming in, the tide's going out, the dash heads for the shore at full speed and then is gone. Well, in the 1880s, a summer guest was staying at one of the manors above the town and was out on the veranda when he spotted this beautiful sailing ship making its way into the harbor. He called for the others to come and see this beautiful ship, and by the time they arrived at the veranda to join him, the dash had vanished. Now, the ship that first fired on the dash in 1942 was a Royal Navy ship, a descendant of the Navy that tried its best to sink her during the War of 1812. Well, the Navy did a full investigation, found the couple, held them in custody. Now, he was the man quoted as saying, "I have not yet begun to fight," when a bigger enemy asked him, "Did he strike his colors?" Now, interestingly enough, the locations he has chosen to haunt are somewhat unusual. He lived at Fredericksburg, Virginia, but he doesn't haunt there. He has been seen in only two places. One's where he's buried, which I believe is at the Naval Academy. See, he was, he died elsewhere. See, the Navy, in typical fashion, and I've seen the same thing in the Army, those with true ability come off second to those with political influence. Battalion and brigade commands go to those who drink and carouse and usually marry the daughters of generals. Well, John Paul Jones was told by the U.S. Navy after the war, "We don't need you." He wound up becoming an admiral in the Russian Navy. And the other spot he's known to haunt may actually take place in American colonies. He became Paul Jones. And later he added John. John Paul Jones. Became a Mason in one of the early lodges in this country. In the North Sea on September 23rd, 1779. The first British broadside crippled his ship. And Captain Richard Pearson of the Seraphis asked him, did he want to surrender? And according to history, Jones said, "I have not yet begun to fight." The Bahama Richard sank, but Jones won the battle.
He sailed it into Portsmouth Harbor, 1781, where they were building the America, which was going to be this country's newest ship. The presence of Jones at the Jones House. What had been his bedchamber is one of the hot spots in the house. And the White Lady of Rockingham has been seen entering and leaving the captain's bedchamber. The crypt in which he's another guard wound up having a conversation with Jones with the greatest of reluctance, we later reported. The crypt was empty except for the honor guard. When someone from behind him said, "What is your name, sailor?" Now, though he was shocked, he didn't flinch. He stared straight ahead, as a good honor guard is supposed to. And then once again he heard this deep voice say, "What is your name, sailor?" And this time he turned around, and there standing in front of him, in the garb of a bygone era, followed right behind him. Well, the sun was bright, and Jones went one way and the guard went the other. Probably on the way to see the White Lady. Because what's a sailor do when he's on shore leave? He gets it on. Well, you know, sometimes it's not the ghost on the ship, but the ship itself demonstrates what might be considered a spirit. I'm talking about the Constellation, reported to be one of the most haunted sites in this country. You know, the Continental Navy had quite a reputation for bravery and seamanship, but it had few ships. The last vessel that sailed during the Revolution was destroyed in a wrecker's yard in 17 ship captains from the Revolution. Now, the ship that was launched in September of 1797 was absolutely beautiful. 171 feet long. Clearly a ship of war. The captain ran up the British signal colors, and the other ship responded in a very odd fashion. So he raised the American signals. And the other ship clearly had no clue how to respond. So the captain ordered the ship made ready for battle. Well, the French tricolor was raised on board that ship. And it tried to outrun the Constellation. a storm came up, and the logical thing would have been to lower. The captain of the Constellation ordered a broadside, and the French responded. Well, the two ships stood and pounded at each other. The French craft finally struck its colors. And in 1800, another major battle with the French ship of the line that again the Constellation won. Well, the interesting thing is that ship has never been decommissioned. And there are many, many spirits tethered to shore for the amusement of tourists. There's one in Galveston, where it was. And families would go aboard and take tours. And one evening this family went on board, and they were met by a very personable young man who gave him a tour, and he explained everything there was to know about that ship. It's been an interesting evening, had some nice guests. Tomorrow night I will have Ed Finch at 8, and I'm waiting on confirmation of a couple of other guests during the first 2 hours. Tomorrow night should prove to be an interesting show. It's nice how receptive y'all have been to this show. This is the end of my first year doing Blog Talk. I have been on the radio off and on for 20 years. Actually, almost 21. But it's always fun to talk to the audience. Well, until tomorrow night at 6, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying, have a truly great evening.